Episode 2, the Men of 8 Gang Podcast, on Saturday, June 28th, 2008. This is Steve Borsch, and today we've got Tim Elliott, Phil Wilson, Graham Thickens, and I on. Garrick couldn't make it this morning, and we've got a lot of things to talk about. And the first one is something that just came across my screen as my wife and I were out walking. Quest is laying fiber in Eden Prairie, and apparently they're doing it in Woodbury and some other suburbs as well. And I've been trying to find out more information about what they're up to, and there's a lot of rumors about it, but it's interesting because there hasn't truly been any kind of competitive option out there, because DSL isn't competitive with cable. The speeds are just too dramatic. And are you guys seeing anything like that?
Not down here in Lakeville. We're going to be on DSL and cable for a long time, I think.
Yeah.
I think, who did we speak with at that last gathering at Clientech? Somebody that you knew, like, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, Steve, that was talking about cable and fiber and where they were. And I think both Tim and I are in Lakeville. And I know that Lakeville has talked about fiber, but it hasn't gotten it very far yet.
Yep. Yeah, that was the guy that was doing the broadband throughout the state of Minnesota in rural areas.
That was Whatever happened to WiMAX? Is anyone going to do that here?
Well, apparently Clearwire, they're still trying to roll this thing out. But you know, I'm hearing just a lot of rumblings about it, but no investments. And then, of course, I was somewhat close to the development with the Minneapolis Wi-Fi because of U.S. Internet, and I was involved with a client that one of the principals of U.S. Internet was on the board, and so I was somewhat aware of what was going on there. And of course, they've had line of sight issues and pockets of dropout, but they seem to be really getting that nailed down.
Well, was it this past week? I believe it was Chrysler that introduced the fact that they were going to be offering the wireless network in their cars for 2009. Was it Chrysler or GM?
It was Chrysler. Yeah.
Chrysler. And in all models, I heard.
In all models, and I find that interesting. It's going to be kind of interesting to see how that all pans out, because we know that Wi-Fi is really spotty around the country, and it's spotty around our own town. So
why wouldn't they put in something like a 3G kind of a cellular connectivity as well? So when you didn't have Wi-Fi, you could at least access the network.
Oh, yeah. Why not? That makes much more sense. Well, when I flew down to Florida to drive back with my daughter, I had my Trio 750 at the time and my Verizon connection, and I even did posts. I did one called iChat at 80 miles an hour, and my daughter was driving, and I was tethered to my Trio, and the connection was so good that I ended up doing iChat video with my wife back in the office. And so, yeah, that seems like quite a feasible option.
So were you this tethered via Bluetooth, or was it?
It was Bluetooth, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So I had a power strip plugged into the cigarette lighter, and the Trio was plugged in, and my laptop was plugged in, and the Trio was sitting in the armrest, and it worked flawlessly.
Can anybody see their screen, but the geek meter is peaking.
Yeah, right. I know.
Well, I guess the question is that should be asked is it a good idea to access the internet while driving?
Depends on what you do. But
I would agree. I think that, you know, I've always been sort of enamored by the concept of video screens that you know, pop out of your DVD player on your dashboard so you can watch movies while you're driving. So I think this is another level of oh, my God, we're going to be killed.
Well, you know, the iPhone is doing this to me, too. I mean, you know, when you can be surfing the web on your iPhone.
I know.
That I kind of draw the line there, but I mean, just checking email and other things on the iPhone while you're driving. It's not a good idea. I'm fighting myself to pay more attention to the road. And although I am using my AT&T broadband card when we're going up on long trips up north and so forth, have my wife drive, and I work all the way. it's 3 hours of time that I can be working online. And I, you know, I get 4 or 5 bars pretty much all the way up there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you just say you hit 4 or 5 bars on the way up there? Did that what you said?
I get 4 or 5 bars on.
Well, it's interesting as this technology proliferates everywhere we go, and I, at some point in the discussion, I want to talk about that because I've spent the last 3 days at a radio broadcast convention here in Minneapolis, and that's very focused on tech. But it's interesting how the technology proliferates everywhere we go. You know what it does to attention span, and what you do, because I think that. You know, I drive a Volvo, for God's sake, so I'm all about the safety conscious, but trying not to give in to the temptation to whip out the phone and check emails while you're driving, it's almost impossible to not do it. So it's going to be interesting to see how it proliferates.
Well, you know, in fact, why don't you talk about that? And Graham, I'd love it if you would talk about the Minnesota Cup semifinals reception that you went to on Wednesday. Phil, yeah, why don't you talk about that event you were at?
And again, I know we very much want to be Minnesota focused in what we do at Minnovate, and I think that the focus here is basically the fact that this convention has been hosted here for 33 years. It's called the Conclave Learning Conference. It was put together 33 years ago by some radio people and some record industry folks for a chance to have what was then just Midwest broadcasters gather for 3 or 4 days every week and take part in sessions. And, you know, in the early days, it started out as a big schmooze fest by record companies as well, with, you know, tubs full of booze and you know, all the trappings of good old fashioned, you know, schmoozing by record companies. But it's really evolved as the record companies have sort of, you know, given up that way of doing business. It's evolved into a great learning conference. And so we've got about 400 or 500 broadcasters and industry types that have gathered here in Minnesota has spent the last 2 or 3 days in sessions, you know, focused on radio. But obviously tech is becoming a bigger and bigger part of what is being done in broadcast. So it's been very interesting to see. I think there's been a couple of things. And I Twittered yesterday from a panel hosted by run by Jerry Del Caliano, and Jerry comes from, you know, radio for years and years, and then he also launched Inside Radio, which was an industry trade publication, ultimately sold it to Clear Channel, and is now a humble media professor at the University of Southern California. But he was in, and he was talking about the things that radio needs to do to really survive and probably thrive in the world of new technology and how we can use it. And what I found interesting is that first, as I look around the room and was listening to the discussion, I'm thinking, my goodness, I can't possibly believe this is the first time some of these people have heard about what's going on in web innovation. And yet there are still, we get into this group, you and all of us, and we travel in the circles, and it's old hat to everybody that we, you know, our peers that we hang with, but with, you know, outside of our group, there are so many people that have no concept of what's happening in tech innovation. So I find it very amazing. And then he also mentioned that he had discovered Twitter, and this was going to be the big thing, and you really ought to get involved in it. And I asked him what his what his Twitter name was, and he said, "Well, I don't have an account."
Yeah. Oh, I saw that. I saw when you did that tweet. I saw that.
Yeah, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, that's like having the bus driver teach you to fly.
Right.
You know, you don't want that going on. But it is very amazing to see how the traditional or old media or whatever you want to call it is trying to figure out ways to embrace new media. So that was very exciting to see some of these people come across this stuff and saying, you can do that. And I spoke with a woman who has a 60-second feature that she produces every year for a radio network, or every week for a radio network. And she does a numerology, energy thing, a very woo. But I suggested that she put together a Twitter feed of some kind of those people that want to opt in to find out, you know, what the energy is like for the day. And, you know, if you were born on this day, what your numerology is all about. She says, wow, you can do that. And it's like, yeah, you can do all sorts of things. You just got to really get out there and explore. So it's been a very interesting conference from that standpoint. And the final thing that I think that there's a lot of takeaways from the event, but I think the ones that we want to talk about here are obviously the new media things, but also I had a chance to see representatives from Sound Exchange and the NARIS folks, you know, the Oscar folks, pitted against the broadcast, the National Association of Broadcasters, David Greer, who is the CEO of ANAB this year, and another broadcaster, kind of go at it about performance royalties and licensing fees for radio stations. It's very interesting to see what has happened in the music industry and how that model has changed so much, and what is happening to figure out ways to, you know, still make a lot of money in the music business without the actual sale of hard goods. And there was no body count, but it was an interesting discussion.
So did you raise your hand and say, first of all, everything should be free?
Everything should be
secondly,
free.
Secondly,
yeah.
Podcasters and bloggers should have access, unfettered access to everything. Did you get into that?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that, and the difficult concept that has to be faced here is that it's going to be very difficult for artists to recoup their money. It's probably more difficult for the record industry to recoup, you know, make any money on music, because they're not being able to mark up their CDs by, you know, 3,000%. But
yeah.
There's also a very good argument to be made that these artists that perform songs, you know, right now, artists or writers and producers receive, royalties every time anything's played, either on the internet, on a satellite radio, or on terrestrial radio. But to date, only satellite, cable, and internet have had to pay actual performance fees. That's a price per play every time they play, which is distributed right to the performers of the music. So somebody doing a cover version of you know, Roy Orbison, yes, Roy Orbison, who wrote the song, gets the fee, but that performer never really saw that money. So the writers always made most of the money. So the performers made their money through record sales and performance, you know, live performance and that sort of thing. So what's happening is Sound Exchange, which has been ordained by the government to be the organization that collects these fees, is trying to enact a performance fee on terrestrial radio, and they've never had that before. Terrestrial radio has never had to pay a performance fee.
Okay, radio. You know what? You're losing me.
I'm sorry.
Well,
Phil,
isn't all that stuff this so out of date as far as all the copyright licensing thing for the music? So shouldn't the whole thing just be blown up and redone anyway?
Well, that would be wonderful, and I think that in the real world, yeah, you want to think, yeah, we've got to start over with a brand new business plan. But and I apologize for getting
there. But that's not what I meant. It was almost as though when I first started a podcast, I remember listening to one that Mike O'Connor did. Mm-hmm. With his sex and podcasting show, and he went through licensing and the due diligence that he did to be able to play some music on his podcast. And I remember listening to this, and it was almost as though, you know, if you had a cheeseburger with onions on it on Tuesday, the licensing fees were different. I mean, it was just,
exactly.
it was almost as though it was arbitrary.
The thing that concerns me the most, and you guys know that I worked for CBS for a period of time here in Minnesota, and we were struggling with launching streams of the radio stations and how to handle the fees. And I was first introduced to Sound Exchange through that process. And what 2 years ago when we were dealing with it, it was like my thought of Sound Exchange was, okay, they're collecting all this money, but they have really no idea how to distribute it. They have collected millions, if not billions of dollars in the last 2 or 3 years from right now, satellite and online and cable music stations. But the ability to actually get that to the performers has, I'm concerned, how is that happening? And the, I guess the thing that I can say to those listening to this podcast, if you have any kind of music interest at all, make sure, if you're a performer at all, make sure you're registered with Sound Exchange. Your chance of getting money for performing a piece, having a piece performed on or played on a terrestrial on everything but terrestrial radio right now, of actually getting some money out of it is greatly enhanced if they know who you are. But the alarming thing is that they collect these millions, and by law, at the end of 3 years, if they have not been able to locate the performer to pay those fees, that money reverts right back to Sound Exchange into their operating budget.
Got it. Wow.
And that concerns me. But it was a very interesting thing, and it was going on right here in Minnesota. Now, I don't know if you'll see it on the news, but sparks were flying, to say the least.
Phil, did you get a sense that the people in the industry really kind of know that radio really needs to fundamentally change, or they're not going to be around very much longer?
I can tell you that, yes, they've heard it from the likes of people like me, and they've heard it from many sources that, yes, it's time to make a change. The problem is they don't know how to change, and it's a very difficult situation. That's, I don't know if you want to chalk that up to industry arrogance, but it's very difficult to get the broadcast industry to change because they are trying to deliver margins that are so insanely high to please Wall Street that they have to cut back on all those things that can help make them more successful. They have to cut back on great air talent. They can't develop new air talent. They have to increase the amount of actually pre-recorded audio and unattended stations, and they have to cut back on the ability to market their product. They have to cut back on a personnel that would actually be, say, a community manager or somebody that would manage an online or interactive initiative. It's a very difficult situation. I think they'll ultimately they'll have to find a way to deal with it. Broadcast will ultimately find a way to incorporate. The audience is going to be smaller. That's just the way it is because of all of these new channels of distribution for music and talk and entertainment. They're going to have a smaller piece of the pie.
Well, but you know what?
There's too much money invested in these sticks, frequencies. So,
you know what, Phil? I mean, here's what was really interesting. There were four boys at our house. My son had an end of summer thing. He's 13 years old. All these boys are 13 years old. And we were talking about creating remixes and mashups because they want to do machinima. They want to be able to record scenes on their Xbox, on my son's Xbox, add music to it, add voice. They want to do a podcast, a vidcast and so forth. So we got into this whole thing and we started to talk about the things they could do and the things that they couldn't do under copyright law. And I got to tell you, I'd love to have these broadcasters explain to a group of 13-year-olds why, when they have all these tools at their fingertips to do screencasts, to grab images, to record audio, and do these mashups and remixes, why they can't do it. Because I got to tell you that no matter what the justification was that I used, they shot me down. Yeah. And I think that's the fundamental change, is the fact that it's so simple to do that they can't control it. And this is all about control.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what it is. And where there's been so much made of intellectual property. I don't know how many conferences I've gone to or sessions I've sat in where there's a lawyer that talks about IP. And it's just incredible to see how there's virtually so many ways to get property without having to pay for it via the web. It's just so hard to figure out a way to compensate. And, listen, through my time with radio, but also more importantly, my time with Local Tone Radio here, it's vital that these performers either
they get paid,
get recognition, and they really should get paid for what they do. I mean, look, there are people out there that are making music or are making content just for the pure love of making music and making content. And that's great. But there's also those that would really like to be able to quit quit their job on the line at Northwest and be able to make a living full time producing music. So it's a difficult situation because I fall on both sides. I love the fact that I have so much access to all of these things. So
well, let's we got a lot of stuff I want to cover today, or that we want to cover. Everybody gave input. I'm dying to hear, Graham, about the Minnesota Cup and what that event was like. I couldn't make it.
And there were 30 finalists chosen?
Yeah, 30 finalists, semi-finalists were named to the Minnesota Cup Business Plan competition. You didn't miss a whole lot. It was really an exception for the folks themselves. And there wasn't enough schmooze time, and it was a formal program that was pretty much just the sponsors talking about how they support the entrepreneurial community. So I would have liked a little more schmooze time, but I did run into a few folks, ran into Matt Bartel, Steve, and I know you're going to be talking about what he's doing. He mm-hmm. is one of the semi-finalists, which is pretty good. Out of 840 some, they narrowed it down to 30 very quickly. And they'll be narrowing it down to the five finalists, I believe, in the latter part of August. So it's an interesting mix. I'm going to post about it on Minovate. Interesting mix of companies, a handful of Web 2.0 internet-related companies made the cut, a gaming network, a couple of music sites. Nabbit's in there, Phil. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know Nabbit had made that cut. That's great.
Yeah. And there are some other startups in there that have been around a while. So they're not all brand new companies. And it's just a real eclectic mix of food. I mean, this is hardly just a tech-oriented event.
Yeah.
It's everything. And there's a review board of judges. I think it's 25 some local luminaries. All of whom purportedly have worked with small startup firms, but there's a lot of sponsors mixed in there. It's kind of an incestuous group of folks. This competition arose out of something the university started 5 or 6 years ago, and it was taken over by Scott Lippman and Dan Mallon, and formalized under the name of Minnesota Cup, I believe 4 years ago. There's no question that it is getting more and more attention every year. The prize went up to $50,000 for the first prize winner, and second and third place get cash as well, and they get some services and publicity around the event when the finalists are named. There's a big event in September. They're doing it on September 11.
Oh, geez.
Why they picked that date is beyond me, especially since I'm going to be at demo a few days before that. Then I got an unsolicited press pass to TechCrunch 50 up in San Francisco on that's the 9th and 10th. They overlapped it with demo, which is totally ridiculous.
Well, they did that on purpose, sir.
Maybe, yeah. They've been doing the in-your-face thing. But I may try to catch a day of TechCrunch 50 on the 10th and then have to rush back here flying on September 11th. Not always my favorite thing to do, but I've done it before. And then that evening is when they'll have the big gala at the McNamara Alumni Center at the U. But anyway, it was a good event. They had 140 some people, I think, at the James J. Hill Library, a gorgeous old place. And it's going to be fun to learn more about some of these companies, and I'll be posting about it with links to those that do have websites. Some of them are pretty rough. Some of them don't tell you much about really what they're doing, and others haven't even posted a website yet or given a public link. But I'll put that list up in a post later today, I hope.
That'd be
hey,
great. Greg,
can you just briefly tell us what these people are vying for, what the winner of the Minnesota Cup receives?
Well, like I say, $50,000, which went up $25,000.
Did you say that? And I didn't hear it. I'm sorry.
Yes, I did. But I the other thing that the background I should have provided is they're really trying to get in front of investors, you know, to raise more money than that. I mean, $50,000, you know, what does that do for you? You know, yeah, I mean, most of them are in the running to raise, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, and have business plans out there where they're trying to hustle that kind of capital. And some of them, as I say, have been around a few years. There's one company that's in the unified threat management business, you know, security appliances, that I know for a fact has been around several years. So yeah, there, you know, it's all part of getting entrepreneurs in front of the wider community and investors, angels, and VCs. And some of those, a few of those, are on the board of judges. It's 25 people. And really, Dave Cleveland, the founder of Riverside Bank, is the lead judge in a way, because his name is now attached to the Minnesota Cup. He's the, you know, one of the, or if not the largest sponsor of this whole competition. So it's got that, you know, investor aura about it.
Have you guys seen TechCrunch elevator pitches, where people they get 1 minute to do a video and post it to YouTube, and then it's delivered on this elevator pitch site?
You mean yes. on their Crunch base?
Well, it's actually a separate, it's pitches.techcrunch.com. And the reason that I bring it up is that I started to go through the semifinalist list and discovered an old colleague from Lawson Software that started a HR management application, and they made the list, and I didn't even know that he'd started that. But it would be great to be able to see elevator pitches on what people are doing. I mean, here's an inflatable patient adjustment device. Well, what is that? I mean, I'd love to know. I'd love to see it. I'd love to understand what they're doing. Another one, exclusive digital printed textiles. Well, that's interesting. You know, is it hardware? Is it software? I mean, you know, and is there a process? And so, I mean, to understand what the essence of their value proposition is, I think would be just terrific.
Yeah, and well, if they have a website, ostensibly they're explaining it, but some of the finalists do not have websites posted. I'd say about maybe even a third of them. But you'll see that when I post the list. But no, I haven't looked at any of those TechCrunch. Are they one? You say they're 1 minute pitches?
Yeah, they give them 1 minute. You should go. Just pitches.techcrunch.com. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah,
we can take a look.
Yeah, that's pretty short to say much, but yeah. You know, at least it gives you a quick idea of what they're doing.
Oh, I think at least five minutes.
Here's my thing. Give me money. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Well, let's slide on here and a few other things. So, John Gordon, who does Future Sense for National Public Radio, is coming to the Twin Cities, and our colleague Garrick Van Buren started a Google map of Wi-Fi independent coffee shops. So I'm going to ask him for an invite. I'll put that in the show notes as well, to be able to plot my favorite independent coffee shops that have wireless.
Is Garrick being exclusive again?
Yeah, he is. No, he's just trying to be helpful. He actually got mentioned on Future Tense because of that. So I'm assuming that was his incentive, but
I love that.
But I you know, we're all a little bit connected to internet broadcasting, and I'm really wondering what you guys were thinking when about this whole updated Wikipedia page. And for those that don't know, NBC was trying to keep the news about Tim Russert's heart attack and death close to the vest until his wife and son, who were over in Italy, could be notified. And someone was tracked down, the person that made an edit to the Wikipedia page on Tim Russert, putting everything in the past tense, saying that he had a heart attack and died, came out before the NBC News release. And it's caused quite a furor. And also, the person that did it, internet broadcasting officials said that they fired him.
Which is not true. That was later updated.
Oh, it was. I have not seen that.
1 week suspension is what I read on Silicon Alley Insider. I believe they updated their post on that. Yeah, and I, you know, I have several contacts over there, and I heard it was I gathered it was a home office employee, so someone here in the Twin Cities. I asked, was it someone associated with the news generation, you know, a content, a news editor kind of a person, and I was told no. I believe I read that it was a she. I don't know that the person will ever be, you know, identified publicly.
Yeah.
What I found interesting is that apparently Internet Broadcasting went back on there and tried to change the edits back to the way it was. And, you know, once it's out there, you can't do that, you know?
Well, yeah, it's too easy. There's an audit trail. It's too easy to go back and do that.
Yeah, well, so I think it was a situation of a company that's not often in the spotlight, has not been seeking much publicity really at all, that I, you know, I put out an occasional news release about announcing new people, but all of a sudden they were caught in a really uncomfortable situation and got more attention than they bargained for on that one. But it appears to have settled down, and the suspension took place, suspension without pay for 1 week. And that's the latest I've heard on it.
Well, I think it brings to light a couple of different things. And what you were saying earlier, Steve, the ease of getting information now, or the free access to so many things. I mean, it's always been a challenge in the press world, in the media world, simply because everybody wants to be the first with the news. So the trying to keep to the standard of let the immediate family be notified first before something like a homicide or a death is reported through the media has always been difficult to maintain.
Yeah.
And I can only think that there was the email that went out to say, you know, that we don't release anything until after the family is notified. Well, you know, I got a little time to kill until NBC gives us this story. I'll just hop on Wikipedia and get a head start on that. Yeah, it's second nature to so many people, especially in the business, to just go ahead and keep, you know, getting information correct.
Well, and then there's another little twist to this, in that Internet Broadcasting was the primary content feed for NBC for the last Olympics, and it's my understanding that they're going to be doing it again for this coming Olympics. So there's an alliance there that, you know, creates another set of complications in terms of, you know, the proverbial, you know, what hits the fan, and calls are made from NBC execs to Internet Broadcasting execs, and basically what the hell happened, and they had to take some action.
Well, yeah, I think
very embarrassing for Internet Broadcasting in that situation. Have they actually announced they're going to do the next Olympics, Steve? I haven't heard that. I know they've done, I believe, two previous ones, but I thought they maybe were out of that business now.
I don't know. That's why I said it's my understanding. I don't know, because I haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen an announcement, but they could be not announcing it and keeping it quiet. I don't know. But
Well, again, I think that there's a couple of different things here. You know, obviously, NBC has a relationship with Internet Broadcasting, and they want to make sure that relationship continues. And I think that there's a sort of NBC probably feels, A, they didn't really like being scooped, and B, you know, especially by the likes of Wikipedia, and they didn't want, and B, that they felt a betrayal of trust with their business relationship. So it's kind of a twofold problem. And I think that I'm happy to hear that Internet Broadcasting didn't fire somebody, because I hate to see anybody lose their job. But I am glad that they did some sort of disciplinary action.
Yep.
I was going to say, what we haven't discussed is apparently the news was broken, you know, ahead of this person doing the Wikipedia update. I heard that the news hit Twitter first. I didn't drill in to read all these stories, but I don't know who was actually credited with twittering about it, which is where this employee may have heard about it and then jumped onto Wikipedia. So that everything comes back to Twitter.
Yeah, it does.
Well, I guess the question that needs to be asked is shouldn't new media be subject to some of the same ethical constraints that existing media, because obviously it's just out of respect for the family. I think that if any one of us had a family member in a similar situation, we would, have liked to have seen it or heard about it from someone else and not someone on Twitter or on Wikipedia.
You know, I think, yeah, you know, but here's the tough part with that. So let's say that you're connected with somebody that you trust and you get a direct message that said, you know, so-and-so just died, and you're right in the middle of a post about something that's germane to that. So you go ahead and you put that in there, without that person telling you, but don't say anything or hold back on it, or, you know, now as a quote unquote journalist, one would verify that that was accurate information and would do a little digging before you went ahead and released something.
Right. And they all the networks, respect the same rule, which is they make sure the next of kin has been notified. Yes. before they report on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But someone just idly Twittering isn't going to know that, you know, that NBC requested that and just, reports it without even thinking or.
Yeah, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Well, these are really big questions, because I've been watching the release, the scoop, you know, of Arrington on TechCrunch about that the Yahoo Microsoft talks are actually back on, and then Kara Swisher from All Things D essentially countering that and saying no, they're not, you know, and I've checked it out and done all my due diligence, and then Arrington kind of coming back with this continued thread of yes, it is, and here's what my sources are saying, and so forth, but that it did affect the stock, and so it's going to be interesting. I mean, you know, there's some conjecture that I've seen on several different sites that all of the buzz about Steve Jobs and him being so thin was exacerbated by the blog posts talking about it. And talking and showing, you know, like I think it was Engadget or Gizmodo or somebody had pictures of him the last three times or three different years or something, that, you know, he was kind of chubby and then he was less chubby and now he was rail thin, and that, you know, Jobs is ostensibly worth $25 billion of Apple's market cap. So what is fair game and what's not? What's conjecture? What's opinion? What's fact? What's, you know, there's a lot of questions that are going on about standards, I guess.
Let me throw something in here, Steve. Did you know that Arrington's predictions are rated by one of the better known prediction market sites at only 14% correct?
Oh. Really?
Watch what you believe about Arrington's predictions. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Prediction market sites are very interesting. Hubdub in the UK is one that I met at Demo in January, and they're doing some interesting things. They also have another site called Pundit Watch, which you get to at punditwatch.hubdub.com. And it's very interesting to see the success rate of the so-called pundits on the internet. You might want to take a look at.
I'm looking at it. That's great.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, I think you should. It's I like what those guys are doing. It's a great team of guys. Actually, from Scotland. And I knew one of the board members from many years ago in the .10 days, and they had quite a successful launch at Demo.
So should we get into the prediction game and predict which city, Minneapolis or St. Paul, is going to land the new Microsoft office?
Nice segue, Steve. you know, I'm betting St. Paul because hasn't Doug Olson located his team up in Roseville or somewhere?
Temporarily. And so,
temporarily.
Yeah, for our listeners, Doug Olson, who's the general manager of the Design Tools Group at Microsoft, is putting a sizable office here in the Twin Cities for engineering and development. He's did the same thing at Adobe and built an office here that at one point had 65 people in it. did the same thing for Macromedia, built a team here to create a new product category, and is now doing it with Microsoft. Doug lives up near White Bear Lake. So my assumption is that, you know, it could be anywhere along that northern corridor. It could even be in the cities. I mean, when he built the Macromedia office, he placed it at the University of Minnesota, right in the Stadium Village area. And then when he did the Adobe office, he did that up in Arden Hills, up on 694. So he's not averse to driving himself. So he's, you know, he's a guy that I'm thinking is going to try to find the best possible spot for as many people as possible. So I think it's a crapshoot, frankly.
Well, if he's smart, he'll get each city playing playing off one against the other.
That's right.
Every smart entrepreneur does it, you know.
So absolutely.
Is Doug going to stay in the Twin Cities? He's not going to move to Redmond.
No, absolutely not. Nope.
Good.
Well, the reason he got back here, this is a fun story. He was out at Adobe. He'd moved out there when Authorware went out to the Bay Area, then joined Adobe later on. And his wife came to him one day and said, "Doug, I love you, and the kids love you, but we're going back to Minnesota." So he went into his boss and said, "So here's what's going on, and I'm going back to Minnesota. I got to go back to Minnesota, so I'm going to quit." And his boss said, No. Go back, get an ISDN. This is in the 90s. He said, "Go back and get an ISDN line, and you know, spend a week or two out here, and just commute and so forth." And he did that for quite a period of time until he ultimately ended up building the office here, and then spent most of his time back here. But yeah, he's adamant about staying in Twin Cities. He's got a beautiful new home, and he's on a lake, and it's
that Minnesota lifestyle.
Hey, baby. That's right.
I'll go for it.
So let's end with what about the week ahead? What are we working on? What are we following? What do we think's coming?
Well, let me dive in here, Steve. This is Graham again. And let me just say that we're going to see a story in the Monday Pioneer Press on internet broadcasting that I just learned about yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Kind of a check back story after a year. Les Susicamo at the Pioneer Press did a story on them last year when they got the CNN investment, $15 million, and probably about the time they named the new CEO, David Lebo from AOL. So he's going to do a check back, kind of you know, what's happened in a year, kind of a thing. And they have some interesting new technology they're going to be announcing as well that will be mentioned in that story. And I plan to do a post on that soon after. Pretty exciting. They're coming into a space with some significant competition that they're going to take on. I won't say what it is, but it should be a good story on Monday. So you want to go to TwinCities.com and check that out.
Terrific. How about you, Tim? We haven't heard a whole lot from you today.
Well, I've been looking at what's happening with Twitter this week and kind of debating whether or not I'm going to continue to stay on that train or look for some alternatives. And what's interesting is that there's so many companies that allow you to just blast status to Twitter and other services that it really doesn't matter. So I think that the conversation that's currently on that platform is going to probably move someplace else. And if I were to bet, I would say it would be something like Friend Feed, mm-hmm. Or maybe Social Thing if they come out of private beta at some point soon, because both those services are, you know, are much more reliable and are working now. Obviously, they don't have the same kind of usage that Twitter does. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, if they're going to be able to solve their problems and continue on their leadership, or will people, you know, this start to move off, and will something like a Friend Feed sort of take over that space?
Yeah, that's my question. You know, one of my questions would be, you know, what do you guys think? Will Twitter be able to solve their problems as they continue to scale and scale and scale? Can they ever hope to catch up?
Well, I think that it's there's no question they've got funding, they've got new bodies, and they're obviously 100% heads down on trying to fix the scalability problem. But the question is, Will they be able to fix it before everybody vacates the service?
Well, and that's what's happening. There's a great post up on Mashable by Mark Hopkins on the
script. I read, yep.
It just went up last night, I think, and it's apparently the cool kids are bailing, but some of the commenters said, they remember the early days of eBay when they had such downtime issues, and it didn't stop them from eventually, becoming a 800-pound gorilla in that space. So, I don't think we can write Twitter off yet, but boy, it's a pretty negative story when you read this Mashable post.
Well, it's different than eBay. I mean, eBay was back when they had their scalability problems. There really wasn't anything else like it. And today with Twitter, there's, at least five other services which do exactly the same thing. In yep. some cases, better. So there's plenty of competition, if you want to look at it that way. And it's just a matter of, will there be a migration or not? And, will someone like a Robert Scoble, just by moving to another service, affect everybody else moving or not?
Well, I think it's interesting to see how this is all panning out because, Twitter has some very, 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 very rabid fans. And rabid fans, those big fans can keep something going for a long time.
Yeah, that's very, very true. But it's, and here's the other part is having my wife come back from a conference where they were talking about Twitter. And I've always been the one who, I evangelized that you got to have a website in 1997. And I evangelized you got to have a blog in 2004. And she said, how come you didn't evangelize Twitter? I really should be on Twitter. And I said, well, here's why. And it's because of the issues. Mm-hmm. And yes, she could have followers and people could sign up. But I mean, her audience is not, early adopters, certainly, and they're not cutting edge typically. But it's for me and having her get on it, it has more to do with the effectiveness of the system than anything else. But it could very well be that the buzz continues to build and, the masses begin to join. And then it doesn't matter if the early adopters are there anymore or not.
Yep.
Yeah. Some of the competition, FriendFeed, is obviously gaining in popularity, but a lot of folks really don't see that as an equivalent to Twitter at all. See it as really a different breed of cat and having a different purpose. And as far as some of the other names, what are they? Plunk and God, there's so many of them. I can't even
Pounce and Plurk and Jaiku are probably the top.
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah. But do they seem to be, are they gaining any traction at all as distant, second, third and fourth place competition here? Or are they gaining from Twitter's problems, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Yeah, I think of all of them, Pounce probably is gaining, but not as much as something like FriendFeed is.
Well, so, FriendFeed is more, isn't FriendFeed more of an aggregator of all of your different little postings?
It is, but it can be used in a Twitter-esque kind of way as well to post to.
Yeah.
How are you guys using, if I can ask a question here, Steve, jumping in on you, how are you using Twitter? Or what do you think, what are the uses of it that you're liking? Having people be able to find you locally or from wherever? What, posting links? That's what I do a lot of.
Well, for me, it's it has more to do with just simply being in the game. Because, if I stand way, way, way back or take a 40,000-foot view of all of these connection technologies, personal publishing, social media, all this stuff, we all know that we're in such an early, early stage that I don't know what's going to win. I don't know what's going to be the dominant communication methodology or the approach or you know, what has the highest signal and the lowest noise, what's going to be the most effective. So I'm just sort of trying them all. And so for me, Twitter is a way of just sort of being in the game. And sometimes it's sort of fun, sometimes it's a chore. But the benefit is, and I try to add value, I don't say, oh, I'm having a cheese sandwich for lunch. It's instead, it's like you do, Graham. I love following you because you always put relevant links in. You're putting value into Twitter. So you know, something strikes you and you say, hey, this is cool. And then there's a URL. That's what I really enjoy. And also then meeting somebody and having them say, yeah, I've been following you on Twitter. And I go, yeah, you know, I read, you know, so then there's this connection and we can talk about some things. So, for me, it's all about the value and being able to exchange that in very bite-sized little chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what it feels like? Just one more thing, I'm sorry. What it feels like, if you've ever sat in a conference and logged on to the IRC back channel, mm-hmm. If you've found out what the little room is in the server and you've logged into it and you watch the flow of the chat that's going on when someone's up talking and all that, sometimes it is drop dead hysterically funny. And in some ways, Twitter feels like a public, easy to use Joe Average IRC back channel.
Yeah. It's great at events. I mean, there's no conferences. And I love tweeting of things that are going on at the conferences. And Phil talked about how he did that at the recent event. And that's one of the prime uses. I mean, I'll sit at a 2-day event. I might do 60, 80, 100 tweets, you know, easily.
That's why we call you Twitter boy.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, you know, trying to put out stuff that you think others are going to find valuable and little, you know, people that can't be at the event. And so,
absolutely. See, I just had to end with one thing, if I could just kind of throw this in here. The post that I did about my meeting with the guys from Blue Shirt Nation.
Yeah.
And first of all, great guys. But I was so struck. I mean, having called on Sound of Music when they were 8 stores and Dick and Brad were guys in short shirt sleeves, picking up boxes and moving around and walking into that building now with the hubbub of activity and 150,000 employees in the organization. And then meeting these guys who took Drupal and Gary Kelling bought the domain name and then installed it and started hacking it and playing with it. And then, you know, the evolution of this, and it's turned into this social network where these guys are a little bit dumbfounded and taken aback that it's been so successful, and they're being looked at as these gurus in corporate social networking, which they're just bemused about it. I mean, which is kind of fun.
And to the point that, well, your post beat Scoble and Shell Israel were in town yesterday to do a video interview of them. So,
oh,
congrats on scooping them.
I didn't even know that. Huh, how about that?
And I'm ticked off. They didn't have taken it. I think they just flew in and flew out. I was hoping to have a drink with Shell at least, but they, you know, had to leave quickly. So,
well, I'm glad it didn't work out because you would have for sure brought your puppet, and that would not have been a good move.
I don't even want to know about the puppet. Is this?
It's the Lauren Feldman teasing Shell Israel in video with his puppet.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, let's wrap up. It's turning out to be actually a nice Saturday here with sun out and so forth. We're going to skip the next couple, 3 weeks here. We'll get back together on the 26th of July with some vacation stuff going on. And I had mentioned that we'd be sporadic throughout the summer with all stuff we got going on. But thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great vacation later in the month.
We'll talk to you soon.
Joy. Okay. Take care, Tim. Bye, guys.
Yep.
Bye, guys.